Hello, good afternoon, folks. It's my pleasure to introduce Chavi Narayan, who will be telling us about why volunteers are our unsung heroes of science.
Thank you very much. Can everyone hear me? Yep, excellent. So are there any graduate students in this small but select audience? Or is anyone who wants to become a graduate student? Okay, there's one silly person there, but welcome. So, well, congratulations and best of luck. I was a graduate student once, and I was interested in the technique called brain imaging, which is a fabulous technique which lets you look inside people's heads without sawing off the tops of their heads. Which is good, which is useful. I mean, it's otherwise difficult to get subjects. And ethics boards tend to kind of frown on that kind of behavior. And I found a lab which did brain imaging studies. And this particular lab's thing was pain, as in that's what they studied. And they had a pain device. And it turned out that the pain device was borrowed from the astrophysics department. Right, it makes sense, I promise you. So it turned out the astrophysics department invented something called a satellite defroster. So when satellites are out in space, they accumulate a lot of ice. And really, when a satellite comes in back into Earth orbit with a whole lot of ice, things don't go so well. So you need something which heats up very quickly, which is a very sort of steep ramp, and which melts off the ice. And that's a satellite defroster. But the satellite defroster found its true purpose when it came to our lab. And its true purpose really was to strap onto the back of your hand and then heat up really quickly until the person went, whoa! And that was the pain device. So we hacked a satellite defroster to make it into a pain device. And my particular experiment was on the relationship between pain and anxiety. So what happens if you're really anxious and something painful happens to you as well? Does that actually distract you from the pain? You don't notice it so much? Does it make the pain much worse because you're already really anxious and fearful, or does it have no effect whatsoever? So this is quite an interesting, scientifically important question. It was really hard to get volunteers for this. I basically had sort of like the anti-chat-up line throughout my master studies because, you know, people would come up to me and they'd be like, so, what do you do? I'm a neuroscientist. Would you like to come to my experiments on pain and fear? And an amazing number of people said, sure, I'll come and do it. And it turned out that my random sample for my master's thesis was basically all men and one woman who was sort of vaguely interested in me, because these are the only people who said yes when I said, come do my experiment on pain and fear. So I realized I was kind of tempting these people up to my lab, which was genuinely on top of the highest hill in town and genuinely had some quite fabulous electric storms. And I worked with a German PhD student, and of course he was German, who wore rimless glasses. And he'd sort of come up to you and he'd sort of stand behind you and go, was that a good pain? You know, kind of completely seriously, with no sense of irony. I mean, the man even wore rimless glasses. And really all I needed was a PI called, a primary investigator called Victor Frankenstein. And I think everyone who's in academia has a sort of point at which they say, you know, if this happens, I'm going to quit academia. If my next paper isn't accepted, I'm going to quit. If my next grant doesn't get through, I'm going to leave. And my personal threshold was, if the next postdoc is called Igor, I'm going to leave. But of course, this is all a horrible, terrible exaggeration, except the German guy really was exactly like that. So to give you a sense of what it was really like, I'm going to show you one of the photos from our lab meetings. So that's a photo from one of my lab meetings. I'm there on the left. So that was my goth phase. It's really hard being a goth if you're Asian, by the way. I really wouldn't recommend it. And that's a senior postdoc. I've just had a paper rejected, and sort of the senior postdoc is like, oh, don't worry, it'll all be okay. But I still didn't have it as bad as some other people in the lab. So there was a separate group of people who were looking at pain, but not just pain felt on your skin, but stomach pain. So again, this is interesting and scientifically important. So stomach pain works in quite different ways. It has different receptors, seems to be processed slightly differently in the brain. So they needed their own pain device. So does anyone in this audience have any ideas on how you might simulate stomach pain? So this is your chance to, you know, get your own funding going, to start your own research career. Any ideas at all? How do you get to simulate stomach pain in a scientific setting? Any ideas? So a friend of mine once said, bad food, interesting. Punching someone in the stomach. I mean, I have to say, it would be points for getting into the spirit of things there. The thing with functional neuroimaging, I mean, it's not a bad idea. I mean, it's ethically a really dubious idea, but it, you know, it's getting there. But what you want to do in functional neuroimaging is you want to take a snapshot of the brain in a particular state. So you want to take a snapshot of the brain when someone is feeling pain. The thing is, the brain isn't just ever doing just one thing like feeling pain. So what you want to do is take a snapshot of the brain when it's feeling pain versus when it's not feeling pain. So you want to turn, you want to hurt someone at the touch of a button, basically. You want to be able to turn it sort of on and off. And both punching someone and poisoning them, food poisoning them, has sort of rather long-term effects. I also don't think it'll get past the ethics committee. So the way to simulate stomach pain is an anal balloon. So what you do is you insert the balloon in the anus, and then you sort of inflate really gently, really slowly, like you have to go very slow, until the person goes, ow, and then you stop. And that is genuinely, you know, it works very well, and despite the sort of EU factor, it's completely safe, and once it's gone, except for the terrible memories, the stomach pain group had a really hard time getting anyone to do the experiments. So they had to do it on each other for the most part. And some of them were going out, and then some of them had a bad breakup. So things were complicated. And for my part, I switched to another topic for my PhD. I was interested in how the brain understands language, which was much easier to find subjects for. And I had a subject who I experimented on throughout my PhD and my master's, who stuck by me. While I did all my experiments, I piloted everything on him. And usually when someone did some experiments for us as a sort of thank you, we'd give them a mug. But after 3 years, a mug, it kind of felt like a pointed personal statement. So I kind of felt obliged to marry him. He was very happy about this. So do you guys want to see one of our wedding photos? Okay. So here's a photo from our wedding. So I was still in my goth phase. We've just exchanged rings there. And that's about the point that I found out that my now husband was genuinely a distant relative of Boris Karloff. So we had a big conversation about informed consent after this happened. But despite the sort of clear and present dangers of this sort of genetic heritage, after many years together, we decided to reproduce our genetic material, or have a child, as it's more commonly known, or as we like to call her. Subject number one. So apparently, I'm told that when she was born, I picked her up and shouted, "It's alive! It's alive!" I was off my head on Gassanet. So there's subject number one, who's actually in the audience today. And she's doing a sort of tool use task that chimpanzees can do, some crows can do. She can't do it. But, you know, she's trying. She's sort of volunteering herself, not entirely informed consent, but her parents have volunteered her, in the name of science. So I'm quite admiring of her, but I'm also quite admiring of the people who did this experiment on her, because children are not good at following instructions. You can't sort of, you know, use the sort of techniques you use in a lot of animal experiments where you sort of essentially don't give animals enough food and then you kind of tempt them with food. You can't really starve kids. So you have to find other ways to do stuff. So how do you actually study cognition in a child? I mean, or even more so in a baby? What do you do? It turns out that one of the most successful techniques is from way back in sort of the 1950s, and it works very effectively. And it works on the basis that children like looking at new things. So when you first show them something new, you know, that's what they tend to look like. They're quite interested. You show it to them again, and they're kind of slightly less interested. You show it to them again, and, you know, they start getting a little bit bored. But then if you show them something new, they kind of perk up. So boring children is a very valid and very good scientific method, because when children stop being bored, they're basically like, aha, I noticed that there was something different there. And they tend to look at sort of new and interesting things, things that they find interesting much more. And when you do those sorts of experiments, you find that children like to look at impossible events like this one. So trains sort of coming off a table and just not falling, keeping on going. They tend to look at this sort of thing much more from quite a young age, sort of 3 months on. But how does a baby know that's impossible? A baby doesn't know anything. So to answer these sorts of questions, it's actually really useful to be able to see the world the way a baby sees it. And to do this, you know, it's really good to generate your own subjects. So this particular subject belongs to an MIT neuroscientist called Pawan Sinha. And he was a very proud father, but also when his baby was born, he was like, I want to strap a camera to his head and record everything he sees and then crunch the data to see if there are any visual categories that emerge. And this is a great idea. But he faced, as he called it, unexpected short-sightedness from spousal quarters. So he faced some resistance. I mean, it's like going, you know, kind of getting review comments back. So he said things like, you know, are you out of your mind? And what kind of father are you? I'm going to report you to the US version of the social services. But in the end, science actually triumphed. And so there's Darius Urgent Sinha. And when you do this sort of experiments, you actually find out that children are really collecting data all the time. They actually are influenced by the statistics of the environment around them. And they integrate these statistics and make inferences. And they're the sort of test inferences. Children are basically doing this, like all of the time. They're watching you all of the time, and they're doing this. And they really are watching you all of the time. So a friend of mine came back from maternity leave, and I asked her, what's the thing that you're looking forward to the most? And she said, I'm really looking forward to having a shit in private. So how do children get away with that? I mean, if anyone else said that to you, you'd be like, no, you cannot accompany me to the loo and watch me while I'm on it. But children get away with it. I mean, they don't have things like an understanding of things like privacy or the needs of another person. And they get away with it because they're so charming. And there is a word for a group of people who are completely, completely charming, also have completely no morals and entirely self-centered. So this is my working hypothesis that babies and small children are basically sociopaths. Cats as well, by the way. But again, this is a testable hypothesis as far as babies at least are concerned. You can actually test, are babies and small children sociopaths? Or do they have a sort of innate sense of morality? So yes, subject number two. Subject number two is 18 months, and she's watching a puppet show. She's watching a puppet show a lot of times where there's this circle which is trying to make its way up this hill. And sometimes this triangle comes along and sort of pushes it up the hill again and again. And sometimes there's a blue rectangle which comes and knocks the circle down. So, I mean, as far as morality goes, this is a pretty blunt triangle good, rectangle bad. And she watches this lots of times, and then she's offered a choice. She's offered these two actual puppets on a tray in front of her and asked to pick one. So, can I ask everyone in this idea, in this audience, with a show of hands, about what's going to happen next? So option one, she's 18 months. She's not going to follow instructions. She's going to try and eat her own foot. Who thinks that's what's going to happen? Good God, not a single person. This is such an optimistic audience, and there's so much frustration going to come in your future when you have children. So option two is she's going to pick the evil rectangle. How many people think that'll happen? Okay, a few realists, not pessimists, realists in the audience. How many people think she's going to pick the good rectangle? So remember, she's not been offered any inducements. She's just watched this. Okay, so few people think that's what's going to happen. And that is indeed what happens. So in this particular experiment, this is what they found. The children just sort of innately tend to favor an agent which is acting in a pro-social way. This doesn't always replicate. There are other situations where it seems that children tend to sort of suck up to powerful individuals. So their morality seems to be flexible and depend on the situation. It's almost as if they're people. But still, it is reassuring when your own child, for example, does this. I mean, her mother is Indian, her father's Jewish. We did not see this coming. So it was a bit of a surprise. But I should clarify that my four-year-old is not actually a Nazi, which is not a clarification I ever thought I'd have to issue. She may or may not have figured out morality, but she just hasn't figured out pointing, and that pointing involves just one finger and not your whole hand. So what she's actually trying to say there is, go get me more ice cream. At least that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. But the thing that I want to say is that really she's a hero, because she actually volunteered now several times to do scientific studies. And really, there's whole swathes of biological science, human sciences, which just wouldn't be possible without someone sort of going, sure, I'll have a former satellite defroster strapped to the back of my hand. Sure, I'll wear prism goggles, which will make everything upside down, so I see everything reversed for 2 weeks. I'll try that. So really, what I want to finish with is a big round of applause for all of the people who volunteer for scientific experiments, and even more so, all of the volunteers who've made this particular festival possible, which I'm told is entirely volunteer-run. So, thank you very much.